Thank you and welcome to the Court of Appeals this afternoon of October 6, 2022. We have one of multiple cases remaining now on our oral calendar for today, and that is in re the matter of Glazner versus State of Minnesota Department of Human Services. And I understand that we have multiple counsel today arguing based upon the briefing. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I understand that the Department of Human Services intends to take 10 minutes of the respondent's argument, while the County Health and Human Services Department intends to take 5. So we have the state with 10 and the county with 5. Am I correct?
That's right.
Okay. Thank you. I'll just indicate, counsel, that we have had a so far pretty smooth sailing in the technology. We are hearing this case by our online Zoom platform rather than live. So I'll just encourage you, if you ever in our oral argument have any difficulty hearing or seeing anyone whom you now see on the screen, just let us know somehow and we'll pause the proceedings to let the technology catch up to us. Do state your name as you commence each leg of your argument, because we keep only an audio recording of the proceedings. And with that, counsel for appellant, you may proceed. You will have an additional 5 minutes of rebuttal time if you choose to use it. Otherwise, 15 minutes to the respondent side. Counsel for appellant, whenever you're ready, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Now that you said it's smooth sailing, we're sure to have technical difficulties.
That's the way it works out.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Jennifer Thompson. I represent Tally Glazner, appellant in this matter. My client has been clean now for 4 years. She had a cocaine addiction prior to the conception and birth of her child. That long-standing addiction led her to some criminal activity, and it has now led her to want to be a licensed alcohol and drug counselor. Unfortunately, she had a maltreatment determination levied against her at the birth of her child and is now precluded from that. So to support the child that this statute is meant to protect, she's resigned to waiting tables at this time and not able to make the income that she's capable of because of this. It's my client's position that the legislature never intended for addiction in the past to be a lifetime sentence limiting a person through a maltreatment determination. The statute that we're here to discuss today is ambiguous. It is not clear. It defines prenatal exposure to controlled substances and then points us away from the maltreatment statutes to the civil commitment statute. Opposing counsel will argue that it is defining only controlled substances. However, the commitment statute references alcohol as well, which is not a controlled substance. It's my client's position that it references specifically prenatal exposure to a controlled substance and that it requires, as is defined in the commitment statute, excessive and habitual use of that substance.
Counsel?
Yes.
If I can interrupt you because we're getting to the crux of your argument.
Yes, Your Honor.
The statute 626-556, where you reference the prenatal exposure to a controlled substance, and I'm going to put 253B02 aside for a minute. Mm-hmm. But in 626.556 sub 2 G6, mm-hmm. there's nothing in that section that provides that the mother must be a chemically dependent person. Would you agree in that section?
In that, correct.
Okay.
Okay.
So in that section, if I read it in part, it suggests that their prenatal exposure to a controlled substance, and we'll get to that, mm-hmm. used by the mother as evidenced by results of a toxicology test. Mm-hmm. So that's the statutory framework of that statute. Agreed?
Agreed.
Okay. So now we go to the 253B02, the one in issue here.
Mm-hmm.
And It seems to me, quite honestly, and please convince me otherwise, I don't know how my colleagues feel, that this is kind of straightforward statutory interpretation, that the prenatal exposure is to a, quote, controlled substance, unquote. If we're being referenced to another statute, then were being referenced to the controlled substances that appear in that statute, and one of those is cocaine. I have a hard time understanding, I understand why you make the argument, but I have a hard time understanding why chemically dependent person, meaning habitual or excessive use, somehow morphs back into 626.556.
Because it's...
So you want to address that?
Yes. It applies because it's directly referenced in the statute.
Well, controlled substances, and again, controlled substance, you mentioned alcohol is in there and it isn't. I agree. Mm-hmm. But it's referencing the controlled substances that do appear in there. This is very an artful statutory drafting. We all can agree to that. And we can talk about the other issues involving your maltreatment finding. But in terms of that statute, it seems to me the only logical interpretation, and again, I'm open to argument, is that the only reference is to a controlled substance that appears in 253B02. And in this case, that would be cocaine.
And I think, Your Honor, if you look at it as defining just controlled substance, that's correct. The phrase prenatal exposure to a controlled substance, that is in the maltreatment statute, among other forms of neglect, prenatal exposure to a controlled substance is a phrase. It's a kind of maltreatment. And so taking that phrase as defined in the commitment statute, the second half of the commitment statute is a pregnant woman who uses habitually, excessively this list of substances. And it doesn't reference controlled substances only. It's this list of substance. So I think it's reasonable to take the whole phrase prenatal exposure to a controlled substance as defined in the commitment statute.
Ms. Thompson, when I first read the statute, I thought that seemed plausible to me. And let me tell you what pushed me away from it, and I'll let you correct me. Mm-hmm. Because I am sympathetic to your argument and the circumstance of your client. But if you look at the full statute, it's prenatal exposure to a controlled substance as defined by and then used by the mother for non-medical purposes. And then this is the part that I think is difficult for you, as evidenced by either the withdrawal symptoms of a child at birth, which may support your argument, but then it goes on, or a meaning singular, toxicology test performed on the mother at delivery. So if you're saying there's a requirement that there's habitual excessive use, but the statute says that whatever it is that's being described in the first clause is proved, there's evidence from a single toxicology test, that would seem to support the idea that we're talking that what is intended by as defined is not the full phrase of exposure to a controlled substance, but the controlled substance itself. You see why I might be led to that interpretation, and help me to understand why I'm wrong about that.
I do, and I think that the key word being or. The habitual or excessive use would be evidenced in those withdrawal symptoms, would be evidenced in developmental delays, or a toxicology test. I think that the habitual and excessive use or a use at the time of birth, I think that is the distinguishing factor, is that if a mother is using a controlled substance the day she's in labor, then that would be neglectful, clearly. But for it to have been showing in the child's tissue, and it's also important to note that it says of the mother, which was clean in this instance, or the child, who was also clean in this instance, it doesn't specifically mention other tissues, placenta, umbilical cord, et cetera. It doesn't mention that. So I think it can be shown to be active or in the past, habitual and excessive. I think that's where, and again, I mean, Judge Cleary pointed out, it's an art thing.
I mean, I mean, the placenta belongs to someone. Either it's the child or the mother. But it's, are you saying the toxicology test on the umbilical cord is not a toxicology test performed on the mother?
This is a clever distinction because I had to look that up, and I'm not a doctor. So is the umbilical cord part of the child? Is it part of the mother?
Well, the umbilical cord is attached to the child, just an anatomy lesson for everybody here. And the statute does provide for a positive toxicology test on the child
or
the time of birth.
Right.
So the umbilical cord tests positive for a controlled substance, then that seems to fall to be captured by the language in the statute. Don't you agree?
But my point in saying that is we shouldn't need an anatomy lesson to interpret the statute. I think
I don't think we do need an anatomy lesson, but
at the very least, the umbilical cord is attached, or it's certainly, well, let me put it a different way. Are you suggesting that a test on the umbilical cord is neither, because you just have to have either here, neither a test on the mother or the child? Is that what you're suggesting?
I'm suggesting that without some amount of knowledge of biology and of the obstetrical process, one would not know whether it's separate tissue, whether it belongs to the child or the mother.
I'm saying it's one or the other. Would you agree? I'm just asking whether you would agree that it certainly is a test of one or the other. It's inconceivable that any biologist, I think, would say it's not a test on either. It's got to be a test on one of them. And if that's so,
I can agree to that it's a test on one or the other. Sure.
Okay. So then it doesn't matter because the statute says it's either one or the other.
But then we get back to the question of the weight of the evidence and what was found, the metabolite.
The statute tells us that whatever is the prohibition, it is evidenced by something very specific, a toxicology test at birth.
Yes, I understand what you're saying. And that brings up the other part of my argument, whether or not it is binary, whether or not there is non-accidental exposure or habitual and excessive exposure.
Let's talk about that for a moment. I mean, the district court received expert testimony that it credited. And are you claiming that those findings, paragraph 11, paragraph 13 and 14 about the expert's testimony, are you claiming that these are clearly erroneous findings not supported by the record?
The district court reviewed, just to go back over the history of it, the DHS judge received expert testimony. The district court reviewed it in making its decision. At the hearing judge reversed the determination. The standard of meeting the habitual and excessive bar was agreed to by all parties at the evidentiary hearing. So clearly the hearing judge found that expert testimony showed that there was a potential for accidental ingestion. And I think that the district court did not, I believe that finding was in error, that it proved that there was a non-accidental exposure to a controlled substance.
You're saying that it was an error because it wasn't supported by the record, the district court didn't consider all of the evidence, or why is it an error?
The record at the evidentiary hearing, the testimony of the expert toxicologist was that swallowing the semen of a heavy cocaine user is basically swallowing cocaine. That was his testimony. And I think that finding that it was non-accidental, or that there was intentional ingestion of cocaine by my client, was in error based on that expert toxicologist testimony. The hearing judge found the same way.
Can I take you back to one other textual concern I have on the interpretation of the statute?
Mm-hmm.
The verb that immediately follows the phrase, as defined by section 253B02, subdivision 2, is the verb used by. And I'm sure we'll hear from your opposing counsel on this interpretive issue, but the other difficulty I have with your argument is the placement of that verb. If the phrase that you'd like us to say applies to the whole exposure to a controlled substance, the exposure part, not just the controlled substance part, then explain how the verb used by is even plausible as a matter of grammar.
In reading the statute by itself, the verb makes sense as applying to controlled substance. If you step outside that statute into the commitment statute and read it and then apply the verb, it doesn't. You're correct.
No, I know. And so we have to decide whether the used by fits your definition, meaning it applies to that the statutory definition incorporates not just the controlled substances listed, but also includes the degree of habitual and excessive. It seems to me that part of our understanding of whether one or the other is accurate depends upon the grammar of the statute of 626, 650, or 556. It seems like the grammar, do you understand how the grammar seems to argue against your point?
I do understand what you're saying. I do, Your Honor. As I'm saying, as written, if without referencing another statute, 656 says prenatal exposure to a controlled substance used by, that makes perfect sense. It's the reference outside that makes it confusing. So I understand exactly what I'm not disagreeing that grammatically the verb doesn't make sense if you reference the phrase prenatal exposure to a controlled substance, because it's, you don't use prenatal exposure to a controlled substance. I understand precisely what you're saying.
And then it would imply that what it's directing us to is not the whole statute, not the whole subdivision 2, but it's directing us to some list of controlled substances in that statute. Yes?
The verb use, yes. I agree that the verb does point to controlled substance. What I struggle with is that this is the maltreatment definition of prenatal exposure to a controlled substance. And that I do firmly believe that whole phrase points to the commitment. And I think that the fact that we're here still trying to interpret it points to its vagueness.
Thank you.
Thanks, Your Honor.
You will. And I just want to make sure if there's any further questions that either my colleague, nope, I think we're ready to move on. So with that, I believe we have counsel for the state as a respondent going first. And if I'm correct about that, if I'm not correct, correct me. If I am correct, you have the floor.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court and counsel, I'm Drew Bredesen, counsel for respondent, the Commissioner of Human Services. This case presents this following question. When a person uses cocaine during pregnancy, does that meet the legislature's definition of maltreatment by neglect? And respondents ask you to affirm the Chief Human Services Judge, Commissioner, District Court, and agree that the legislature defined neglect in clear terms to include the instance where a mother tests positive for cocaine use at birth. The central question here is the phrasing of that definition of neglect by prenatal exposure, and specifically whether it's impossible to ascertain legislative intent after all rules of construction such that it is void for vagueness. And that relevant language, as we've been talking about, is prenatal exposure to a controlled substance as defined in section 253B sub 2, used by the mother for a non-medical purpose. We've touched on this a couple different angles this morning already, but grammatically that indicates that the use is of the controlled substance. It is not of the prenatal exposure. The comma framed phrase is placed in such a position that if it had been meant to define prenatal exposure, then it would be placed in an earlier section. And beyond that, the language of the rest of the clause agrees that this is a definition of controlled substances by reference. It squares with 253B02 sub 2. That subdivision refers to multiple substances, specifically using the term substances and including cocaine. There is simply no ambiguity with respect to appellant's factual situation involving cocaine.
There is a bit of it. A controlled substance as defined by, and if you go to the subdivision, there really is no definitions. We have a list, and it follows a substantive description of some of a person who's, you know, habitual or excessive in use. But I mean, it's, you agree, it's not that, that the language in subdivision 2G of 626.556 does not match precisely with the language that's referenced in the subdivision it cites.
It's true, Your Honor, that 253B02 does not use the word define, but in referring to substances that are exclusively controlled substances, that is a definition. Here, the legislature is defining in the sense of naming a subset of the controlled substances category. And that subset plainly includes cocaine. Fixing or establishing what fits in a category is one of the definitions of the word define in Black's Law Dictionary. And so this is what the legislature is doing, is using a subset. For statutory context, for instance, paragraph 8 of the neglect definition refers to controlled substances in general terms without any qualifier, understanding that the reader knows what controlled substances are. So paragraph 6 is defining the relevant subset, and that subset unambiguously includes cocaine. And so there simply is no vagueness here such that the statute should be void. Next, that neglect definition unambiguously does not require a showing of habitual or excessive use. When you compare the language of the neglect definition with section 253B02, what you see is that the legislature used the non-medical purpose language and excluded habitual or excessive use. So that neglect definition uses the phrasing used by the mother for a non-medical purpose immediately after the reference to section 253B02, which is language from that section. And then the neglect definition excludes the language habitual or excessive use. The legislature could easily have continued its citation and using of that language, but excluded habitual or excessive use. So it is clear that the legislature purposely left it out of neglect, the definition of neglect. It did not want habitual or excessive to be a requirement of a maltreatment finding. And that makes sense. Requiring habitual or excessive use is inconsistent with the neglect definition and its other sections. You know, courts are finding habitual or excessive use for chemically dependent persons where a person is risking their own death, wandering the streets alone in winter, failing to eat to the point of potential organ failure, the types of conduct that are long past the standards where a person would be failing to feed or shelter a child. The legislature did not intend for a maltreatment finding to be considered such an extreme outcome that it would only happen alongside civil commitment. Instead, proving prenatal exposure without habitual or excessive use is in line with the rest of the neglect definitions, which include things occurring from, for instance, single instances of failing to provide supervision, failure to provide shelter, failure to protect from risks, single instance issues, often very short in time. So there is simply no habitual or excessive requirement here. It's inconsistent with the statute. If, for context, you know, the maltreatment determination here, it, you know, there's discussion of a resulting disqualification to Ms. Glasner, but that is outside the scope of this case. What is inside the scope of this case is the determination itself. And the determination does not require, does not necessitate an outcome. It's simply a flag for DHS to look closer for potential risks to the public. So first you have a maltreatment finding, a maltreatment determination. And if an agency finds that occurs, and if the maltreatment is later deemed to be serious or recurring, then you can be disqualified from some jobs. But for both the maltreatment determination, which is what this case is about, and the disqualification, which this is the first time I'm hearing about any disqualification for the appellant. In either case, there is an opportunity for an evidentiary hearing, reconsideration request, and even then it can be set aside if, for instance, you are rehabilitated or if the population that you would serve in a job is not similar to the population you've maltreated, things like that. So the maltreatment determination itself does not require an outcome. It is simply allowing DHS to be aware of the potential for risks to the public and then still allow folks to provide services where that's appropriate. So in short, the neglect definition is not ambiguous, let alone void for vagueness, certainly not vague beyond a reasonable doubt. And it is evident that the legislature intended a maltreatment finding when a person tests positive for cocaine use at childbirth. I just wanted to note that I'm also hearing for the first time today a claim that the parties agreed that the appropriate standard was habitual or excessive at the evidentiary hearing in this case. The transcript does not reflect that. I encourage the court to review the transcript. I see no evidence of such an agreement in the record on the transcript. So cognizant of time in this case, unless there are further questions, Commissioner respectfully requests the maltreatment determination be affirmed, and I yield my time to the county.
I do not see any further questions. The county will have 7 minutes to respond or to continue the response.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, I'm Tim Syme, Assistant Sherburne County Attorney on behalf of Respondent Sherburne County Health and Human Services. As an initial matter, I want to correct a statement that we made in our brief relating to the standard for determining whether substantial evidence supports the agency's maltreatment determination. I did notify counsel this morning that I'd be making this correction after I discovered it, and we'll follow up by filing an errata sheet with the court. But on page 10 of our brief, we state that it's appellant's burden to establish that the agency's findings are not supported by substantial evidence, and then we cite to matter of R.S. Edenhouse. A more accurate statement from that case is that it is appellant's burden to show that the agency's findings are not supported by evidence in the record. And so again, we'll follow up with an errata sheet. As to the standard of review, just to clarify, to the extent our misstatement led to some confusion, the question of whether the agency's decision is supported by substantial evidence is a question that this court reviews de novo. It's under the matter of Redderoff case that we cite in our brief. The Supreme Court has said whether or not there's substantial evidence as a whole is a question of law that this court would obviously review de novo. So I just want to make that correction. As to substance...
And just to be clear, you'll make that correction in writing for our record.
Correct. We will follow a writer sheet.
Thank you.
As to the substance of our response, most of the argument today has been on the legal issues, and so I don't want to simply just repeat what we have in our brief, but I did want to respond to two things counsel for appellant mentioned. One is, I agree with Mr. Bredesen. I'm not aware of anything in the record where the parties agreed that the legal standard that the agency should apply was habitual and excessive. I have not seen that in the transcript. And this case, in fact, below was litigated on whether or not that was the correct standard. The county objected to that, and the co-chief human services judge corrected Judge Haluska's response to or finding on that. Second, counsel mentioned that it's their position that the agency's findings are incorrect based on Dr. Jones's testimony, that the claimed reason, possible reason for the positive cocaine test result, toxicology result, was through sexual acts. That statement from Dr. Jones appears on pages 32 to 33 of the transcript. It's in response to reference to a prior phone call on that. That was not Dr. Jones's final word on his position on whether that was possible. He went into great detail explaining that not only is there no scientific study that supports this claim, that that's a possible reason for the positive toxicology test, he went on to explain in detail the amount of fluids that would have to be ingested in order to even possibly result in a positive test. So the findings that both the agency made and the district court upheld are supported by Dr. Jones's direct testimony on that issue. And so for those reasons, I do want to point out, and I think Mr. Bresden cites this in his brief, that the inferences drawn from the evidence as found by the agency must be that the this court would defer to the agency on that. And that's really what we have here. This is not a cursory explanation of we know we have a positive test. We know it's not disputed that there was cocaine ingested in some form. There was a lengthy review here of the claimed possible explanations that were ruled out by the experts, taking all of the circumstantial evidence into account, drawing the reasonable inferences from that circumstantial evidence. The agency reasonably found that Ms. Glessner ingested cocaine during pregnancy, resulting in a prenatal exposure. Because of the substantial evidence in the record, we agree with the AG's office and DHS and ask that this court uphold the agency's decision. And unless there's any questions, I'll either cede the rest of my time to Mr. Bredesen or cede the rest of our time period.
I don't know if we're going to have too much of a tag team. So I think, unless there are any questions from my colleagues, I think we'll move on to appellant's counsel for rebuttal. I don't see any questions. So counsel for appellant, you have, before we start your clock, I'm just going to, so we don't take away your time with a long-winded question, I do this sometimes, I'll just put my concerns on the table and give you an opportunity to address them. I don't speak for the court. These are my own concerns. Let's assume this, I want you to assume this is my presumption at this point, that the language in the statute is imprecise, it's sloppy, it may even be confusing, but it's not so confusing that it would lend itself to any reasonable interpretation other than the single interpretation that the court, the district court adopted and the respondents are arguing for. Assume that's my position, my movable position. I've been pushed away before and I wanted to give you an opportunity to move me away, but I want you to at least consider that as you begin your rebuttal. And with that, you have the floor.
Thank you, Your Honor. First, I would like to point to
restate your name so that we have it for the audio record.
Thank you for the reminder. Jennifer Thompson for the appellant.
Thank you.
I would like to point to the transcript at, it's actually in the conclusion of my brief, the transcript at page 11, line 3 through 12, 11, and page 19, 8, 1. It's in the conclusion of my argument that Judge Holowska states to all the parties that Sherburn County has the burden to establish by a preponderance of evidence that appellant, quote, meets the definition of a chemically dependent individual under that statute, end quote, there was neglect by prenatal exposure that was not accidental. So in the transcript, there was a discussion at the evidentiary hearing that all the parties agreed that she had to be shown to be a chemically dependent person, which is the habitual and excessive use standard. Again, the reference is in the conclusion of my brief. To Mr. Syme's point about the amount of fluids, Dr. Jones used the word boatload. He was very imprecise. He didn't quantify specifically how much semen a person would have to ingest. He just said boatload. So, and I apologize, Your Honor, I have to be candid and frank. This is one of the most embarrassing cases I've had to speak about on the record. It is what it is. As far as finding in favor of the agency's decision, the district court is bound by that. But again, as cited in my brief, Dozier and Davies both point to the fact that the Court of Appeals is not bound by the agency's expertise or by the agency's decision. Specifically, it's a question of law, and the district court's decision is not binding on this court. That's from Davies. I wanted to address Mr. Bredesen's argument that the definition, the subset list, is also can be interpreted as a definition. The way that gets complicated is it's the definition of prenatal exposure to a controlled substance that points to the definition of a chemically dependent person. In the civil commitment statute, it's under the definitions that it's pointing to. So, and it also, in quotes, later the prenatal exposure part of that definition says a chemically dependent person includes a pregnant woman who uses habitually excessively. And then it lists certain controlled substances. It doesn't list all of the controlled substances. Controlled substances have their own definition elsewhere in the statutes. So again, my argument is that it is defining prenatal exposure to a controlled substance because it's pointing to the definition of a chemically dependent person. As far as a determination not necessitating an outcome, it does necessitate an outcome. I see this in so many of my child protection cases where a maltreatment determination is made and a person who works, let's say, in a nursing home loses their job because of that determination. It has a very tangible impact on a person's life. And if it's to be levied that way, the definition of what constitutes maltreatment should be precise because it does have a serious impact. And I think as far as the level of ambiguity here, I'm just getting to the definition. To your Honor's point about it being not so far afield that reasonable people can't agree, we've got at the hearing, at the evidentiary hearing, we had a judge agreeing with my interpretation. We had the district attorney agreeing with my interpretation. And it wasn't until it went to a different judge that disagreed. And here we are still with another, you know, with an AG and the Court of Appeals and another district attorney who is disagreeing as to the definition. I think we're all reasonable people and of reasonable intelligence, and we are disagreeing. And I think by its very definition, here we are. This is vague. When I was doing civil commitments myself, I read it the way I do today. And so, and that was, you know, at the Meeker County Attorney's Office, I applied it that way. And the county attorney agreed with me and the social services agency agreed with me there. So we do have reasonable minds interpreting this statute differently. That makes it vague and void. Thanks, Your Honor.
Well, thank you. And thank you to all counsel. We recognize that this is a, you know, we have a legal question, but we know that there are human beings behind this one and that lives, the decision implicates lives, and we're mindful of that. Of course, we still are one way or the other. We have to apply the law, however it turns out. But we very much appreciate your argument. And